911, what's your emergency?
Help. I'm on a date with this guy, Chuck, and it's not going well.
This line is for emergencies only, sir. Is this an emergency?
He took me to a Sondheim concert.
Help is on the way. Well, it couldn't be me, because I would never call 911 to get out of seeing a Sondheim concert.
No, I'm saying, like, because I love Sondheim, and I would love to go to a Sondheim concert, and if my date called 911 to get out of the Sondheim concert specifically, not only would I block them, I would, like, go to, like, their house, and I would tape, like, something on the door that said, like, an absolute fucking loser lives here.
Yeah, I would, like, hack into their bank account and ruin their credit score. But we'll get to that part of the episode. Welcome back to the First Respodcast, guys. Today's episode covers a very exciting one. Season 2, Episode 15, Ocean's 911. I love it when a title, in such an effort to be an homage to a movie, just ends up, like, not really making sense. Ocean's 911.
It doesn't make any sense at all. The pun doesn't work. The pun literally only works if you read it, like, all of those, like, those misfortunate tweets where it goes Ocean's 911. Like, it's Ocean's the only way the pun works. Like,
yeah. But this one was written by Andrew Myers, and I have to say this is interesting because this was Andrew Myers' first episode, and he is a very prolific 911 writer. Shall I read out all of the episodes he's written?
I would love to hear it. I would love to hear it.
So after this one, he also wrote Season 3, Episode 10, Christmas Spirit, the Season 3 Christmas episode. Season 3, episode 12, Fools, which I don't really remember, but I remember it being another funny, like, awful people kind of episode, just a lot of fool characters. Season 4, episode 3, Future Tense. Season 4, episode 9, Blindsided. I don't really remember those two, but I do know that season 4 is, like, my favorite season as far as I remember, so I'm sure they were awesome. Season 4, episode 13, Suspicion, which, one of the gayer episodes of 911 ever. Season 5, episode 2, Desperate Times. Season 5, episode 6, Brawl in Cell Block 911. Season 5, episode 13, Fear of Phobia. Season 6, episode 1, Let the Games Begin. Season 6, episode 8, What's Your Fantasy? Season 6, episode 12, Recovery. Season 6, episode 18, Pay It Forward. And, get this, season 7, episode 4, Buck Bothered and Bewildered.
Oh my god.
He was a co-writer. Okay. It was written by two people, but still.
Right.
Season 7.
Well, okay, first of all, that episode could not have been written by one person. It was simply too good.
Yeah, like, was Rome built in a day?
Right. that's his last writing credit on the show?
We have Season 7, Episode 9, Ashes, Ashes, and, you're never going to believe this, Season 8, Episode 6, Confessions. Guys, we might have a bit of an ally on our hands.
Not Buddy's strongest soldier. Oh my,
like,
god.
Andrew, we see you. Okay? We see you.
He wrote
you.
Eddie getting shot. He wrote Bye Buck.
He wrote Buck Tommy Bones.
He brought Buck Tommy into this world and said, I brought it into this world. I can take it out.
And I respect it so much. I mean, hey, maybe Andrew was responsible for writing, like, all the Buddy parts of Buck Bothered and Bewildered, and then the other writer was responsible for the Buck Tommy parts.
That would be fun.
That would be interesting. And, like, Andrew saw all of those people saying, well, no, it was a bait and switch. Buck was actually trying to get Tommy's attention the whole time. And he said, you know what? I can't have that. I'm breaking him up.
No, literally. And, like, okay, it's so... First of all, can we talk about how absolutely no one was buying that? Because going back in season 8, like, where we are now with Tommy himself, like, you know, circling back to Eddie
totally
being competition.
Ryan.
We've been fully, fully vindicated. No one bought Buck Tommy because everyone knew it was about Buddy.
Somebody in my YouTube comments trying to argue that point with me. They were like, well, no, the whole thing was a bait and switch. You can go back and watch the entire episode and everything was secretly about Tommy. I was like, oh, yeah, Then what about the scenes where, like, Tommy is nowhere to be seen and Buck is like, please notice me as I'm lifting weights, Eddie, please. Like, how is that
but
a bid
see,
for the other
but
guy's
you see,
attention?
Eddie was on the phone with Tommy. Eddie was
he
on
was
the phone
actually,
with Tommy.
We never get he confirmation wasn't... of that. He could have been on the phone with literally anyone. He was
that's
on the
true.
Phone
that's
with...
That's true. It was literally just Eddie not paying attention to Buck.
Yeah. Eddie was on the phone with Chimney. Or no, Chimney's in that scene. Eddie was on the phone with... Taylor Kelly, and you know, they were queening out together, but Buck never would have known
that. I actually
think
it's very possible he was on the phone with like one of his sisters or something, or maybe like, you know,
his son,
like,
perhaps.
Tia Papa or something. Just like, because the way that he talks on the phone in that scene never made sense with him talking with Tommy like that, because they don't, cause when,
they don't like giggle together.
Eddie and Tommy hang out, they're not giggling, they're not like, you know, having that kind of relationship. It's literally just them like broing out together and like,
no, they had a very
know,
straight bro relationship, which is kind of makes it funnier when like at the end of the next
gay.
Episode when Eddie is like, wait, Tommy's gay, it's like, yeah, he wouldn't have known, because even though yeah. they were kind of going on dates together unbeknownst to Eddie, they were like extremely heterosexual feeling events. It's like, oh, let's go
think...
see a fight in Las Vegas.
So
let's go play
so you
pickup
also think
basketball.
That Tommy was like trying to fuck Eddie too.
Well, I think that's the most logical explanation, but maybe Tommy just has so little game.
That might be, well, very possible. Probable, in fact, one might say. But I think it would make sense in the fact that, you know, after Tommy and Buck started going out, that Tommy, not only did Eddie get a little less invested in his friendship with Tommy, but Tommy also seemed to really stop hanging out with Eddie nearly as much.
These three just have the messiest thing going on in general. It's like it's like middle school. It's like, okay, you liked the one guy, but he wasn't available, so you settled for the other guy. And then when you broke up with him, the third guy stopped talking to you out of like childish loyalty, which I respect it for the record. And now you're like glad that the competition is gone. It's just like, you guys, just be adults about all of it.
As someone who, you know, has gay friends, has dated gays in my day, and
wait,
has
you're
witnessed
gay?
No,
okay,
no,
good.
And,
that's
and
what
has
I
witnessed
thought.
Like gay friend groups, like, you know, there's like gay friend groups on Instagram and stuff like that. Like I've known people that who like all of their friends are other gay men and everything. And I will say it does get like not like literally incestuous, but like, you know, metaphorically incestuous, like
right.
incest in the friend group.
Yeah, maybe this is realistic.
Yeah, like maybe I like the messiness and the sort of the, you know, dropping people for other people and stuff like that. That makes that I will say that does feel truthful. Yeah, as much as it is very, very depressing.
Let's get into the episode, guys.
I am excited to talk about this episode, and
me
I
too.
Like this episode.
I
kind
love
of for,
this episode.
Like, it's such a fun episode. I love how streamlined it is. I love how focused it is on one particular story, and it's a story. It's not about like character drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story about a call, but like one big overarching call that does advance the plot for, you know, several of the characters, like in their own personal journeys, but also just is a thrilling piece of plot to follow.
Yes. And right? That being said, although it isn't like character drama, character development focused, it is character focused, I think. Like a lot of the fun of the episode comes out of seeing how our various characters behave in this situation.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of fun. It's a very fun like episode in terms of how it's cut together. It's just following
yes.
this kind of heist formula. It's doing
very well
a little
directed.
Stylistic homage. And so
mm-hmm.
it is more kind of peppy and fun than a lot of other episodes.
Yeah. It names the Ocean's films as its biggest
right.
inspiration, which I feel like
I
is
haven't
sort
seen
of
the original.
The
I've only seen the Girl Boss one with Sandra Bullock.
So the original actually was from the 60s, and that starred the Rat
mm-hmm.
Pack, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean
right.
Martin,
Steve
that sort of thing.
Or no. Does it have Steve McQueen?
And then they made a sort of a remake in I think it was either the late 90s or the 2000s with, you know, obviously George Clooney and
uh-huh.
Brad Pitt and
oh, it does not have
like,
Steve McQueen, sorry everybody. I missed that.
Old-timey people, you know.
The same types of guy as Steve McQueen.
And, you know, they made two sequels to that. And then in 2018, they made the best film in the franchise, in my opinion, because it's an absolute mother convention. And also just a great film, Ocean's 8.
I love that movie. That's the only one I've seen, I'm embarrassed to say.
It's so much fun. It's like, in my opinion, it's the most fun of all of the Ocean's movies. And also, I think it has the best cast. That's my hot take.
It does have quite a cast. It's such an A-list cast.
Rihanna's in it. Sarah Paulson, Sandra Bullock, Cate Blanchett, Mindy Kaling, Anne Hathaway, Awkwafina, and and of course Helena Bonham Carter as the eight in Ocean's 8. The only miss in the cast is James Corden, and for some reason, this is still the only role that I think I've ever actually properly liked James Corden in. I think he played this one well. It's like the best of a bad bunch.
Well, it is funny to be
like, I still
hate
him, but
tell me the movies from 2018 without telling me it's from 2018. Awkwafina, like, James Corden.
I think she did this on the back of Crazy Rich Asians. Am I wrong? I think that was 2017,
yes,
right?
I believe Crazy Rich Asians was like the year before or something. We open with a bank that's closing for the day. It's sort of an unusually normal and peaceful opening to a 911 episode, right? We just have a bank is closing up. They get the last few customers out. They close up. And then they start having a little party because the boss is retiring. Yeah. This older man,
Mr. Prentice. A little retirement party. Oh, it's very, a very sedate retirement party, I will say.
I hate to say it, but this was reminding me of Severance, just in the, like, how mundane and kind of sad this retirement party was. And, you know, he has this line about, like, you know, we made it through the scandal with our financial whatever. We made it through the scandal, which I'm happy to say that didn't affect this branch at all. And they're all just like eating
that's
this
promising.
Sad.
Right.
Yeah, they're eating this sad cake, and it's like this sad little group of people. And that, it reminded me, on Severance, they're always doing these things where it's like, you guys have been so productive this quarter, we're giving you a melon party. And they just like stand around pathetically eating chunks of melon.
See, you got Severance. Like, I got like the American Tragedy of Death of a Salesman. Like,
totally.
this sad retirement party. That's like this whole man's career is amounting to the sedate bowing of heads of his coworkers. Like, you know, it was so depressing to me.
It is very
depressing.
There
was nothing triumphant about it, or there's nothing bombastic. It was just this guy's last day on the job before he retired, which is fine.
One of the saddest lines is when he says, like, you know, I was disappointed that corporate decided not to name me manager of the year, but it was an honor to be nominated.
Why did he say that during his step down speech, basically?
I get it. It's like you've got to get one last petty dig in for the thing that, you know, the people who wronged you. I get that, and I think that was kind of a slay. Maybe the mundanity and the sadness of this occasion sort of explains what ends up happening throughout the episode a little bit.
The alarm goes off and the party is sort of interrupted, right?
Not like the alarm, like the bank is being robbed, but just the guy's watch alarm goes off and he's like, oh, it's time. I guess they do this thing every day where they I guess they do this thing every day where they unload money from the vault into like an armored car that I guess transports it to another location. This is a thing. Most banks nowadays do not actually keep that much money in the vault because of bank robberies. Like, it would just be kind of stupid to have every bank branch have like millions and millions of dollars in cash in their vault. So they're unloading it.
This is why bank robberies are mostly like digital now and everything. This is basically why. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We cut to the armored car, and who should be in there but
my
Karofsky
God.
From Glee. A recognizable face.
It's always such an absolute trip when you see an actor specifically from Glee, when Glee is their most known role,
yes,
appear in literally anything else. I had the same thing when Romy Rosemont was on the show. He is Karofsky. It's not,
he's nothing else.
Max Adler doesn't exist anymore. This is his legacy.
The homophobic gay guy from Glee.
Karofsky's not a bad character. His relationship with Blaine in season 6 was you know, but like Karofsky is a good character, and you know, you have the cough syrup sequence and all that stuff. Like it's a good legacy to have, but he shows up and it's like a jump scare almost. I don't know how else, because I don't want to be mean, because I love Max Adler. He's an excellent actor, you know, very handsome, you know, and it's just, you see him and it's just jarring. It's jarring. It's like,
it is
what
jarring.
Are you doing here? Get back on Hulu. Stay in my memory.
But yeah, he has a fun little role in this episode where he is one of these like armored car money transporting guys. And he's waiting in the car while his colleague goes in to actually do the unloading of the money. And the other money guy comes in, immediately starts flirting with the lady who works at the bank, which I was kind of digging this. I thought they were cute. He's like, did you change your hair? And she's like, same cut, same color. And you know, you can tell they're both into it. I loved it.
It was sweet. But the thing that you sort of notice right off the bat is that, you know, Mr. Prentice or whatever, a crazy name by the way for someone who works in finance, Mr. Prentice, because it's like, so you had okay, I could see you on TV, sure. And I'm gonna leave it at that. The thing that you notice about him right off the bat is that he's very serious about his hand sanitizer.
He is. He's using a lot of hand sanitizer.
More on that later.
He ends up shaking hands with the money unloading guy. And, you know, because the guy was like, it's been a pleasure working with you. Like, happy retirement. Mm-hmm. Happy retirement. The guy starts to leave the vault when suddenly he starts kind of choking, and then he starts foaming at the mouth. He collapses and he's totally foaming at the mouth. Everybody starts freaking out. Call 911, right? Cut to our title card. Mm-hmm.
Somebody call 911. I love it when they say that line, because it's such an...
You're like, yeah.
And then the 118 responds, obviously, because...
Yeah, we go back to Karofsky in the car, who has no idea what's going on inside, but he sees these fire trucks pulling up. He's like, what is going on? He manages to flag down Buck. I just wrote down, like, this is so iconic that we have a Karofsky and Buck interaction in the universe.
I know. It was like a meeting of the minds.
Truly. So Karofsky asks him, he's like, what's going on in there? Like, what's happening? And Buck doesn't really have any answers. He's like, Karofsky says, my partner's in there. Work partner, presumably. Hopefully he's not life partners with the guy in there, because if so, that guy is totally emotionally cheating on him with the woman at the bank. But he's like, my partner's in there. Buck's like, you know, was he acting weird before you guys got here? And he says, no, not at all. So the 118 gets in, and Eddie immediately thinks this is a nerve agent. Mr. Prentice inside the vault has also started displaying these same symptoms. He's also down and foaming at the mouth. So Eddie, army guy Eddie, is like, it must be a nerve agent. I got trained for this out in the field. It's like,
of course,
okay,
he
Eddie,
jumps
sure
to that. It's like, sure. And like, it is one of those questions that you'd have of like, well, if it was like an aerosolized nerve agent, then why wouldn't everyone be having this reaction, right?
Like, you know what? Eddie just wanted to show off, and that's okay.
A baby girl wanted to flex his little training muscles or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because
he's
of that,
like,
they
guys,
they make
remember
the decision
how I was in
to...
the army? You guys, I was in the army. Have I mentioned I have a silver star?
So you know, quarantine procedures. They have to lock down the building. And as this is happening, the vault door starts to shut with Mr. Prentice still inside, and so first responder Hen rushes back in to help try and get the guy out before the vault door closes. I don't know what her game plan was here. It's just one of those snap decisions that doesn't really make sense when you like look too hard at
it. Yeah, it's not totally clear if she was planning to like drag him out or if she just wanted to make sure someone was with him, but she grabs hold of him and he kind of grabs her face, like he won't let her drag them both out of there. And so before we know it, she has been shut in the vault with Mr. Prentice, And, you know, yeah. Eddie and Bobby are like pulling on the door. But of course, it's this like heavy duty, high security bank vault. They can't stop the door from closing.
So it's the worst place in the entire world to be trapped. You know what I mean? Trapped. It's the worst place in the entire world to be trapped because it's literally a bank vault. It's literally the one place in the like in the city that is most like heavily fortified just in terms of like building materials because they have super valuable money in there. So it's like impossible to get in. It's like, and so they mentioned later in the episode, like the horror stories of people getting locked in bank vaults. I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't want to be in there. Shit. Yeah. I saw that whole episode of Family Guy when Stewie and Brian got trapped in there. I don't want to end up like them, you know?
Yeah. It's very, very heavily locked down, which I mean, luckily, you know, the fire department's already here. So if anybody can figure out a way in, it's them. But yeah, the 118 are like, well, we've got to get in there. Like, that's one of our people. And we don't know if this is like a contagious thing or an airborne thing. We've got to get them out of there. And the bank, the lady at the bank is like, well, it's on a time lock. Like, we can't just open it. But there is, we could try and calling the vault company or whatever and see if we could get remote access.
Yeah, it's like WAPS, like we're it's going to take some time. And Hen, meanwhile, she's in there and they see on the CCTV footage that she starts to have the same reaction. She starts to seize and
shot
falls.
Like, it's shot like a sequence in a zombie movie.
Yeah, no, it is.
Hen is like facing away from the security camera and she's just standing there motionless. And, you know, on the outside, Bobby's like, Hen, can you hear us? And instead of like acting like someone in this situation probably actually would, like a first responder, you know, she would probably try to communicate in some way as this is happening to her. But no, they have to do it like the zombie movie. And so Hen is facing away and then like slowly, dramatically turns toward the camera and you see the foam coming out of her mouth and then she collapses.
It was like Evil Dead or something. It was like 28 days later and she's like getting infected with the rage virus. Like,
exactly.
It was insane. I love this show for that because it's so stupid and campy and over the top. Yeah. I love this fucking show. She falls and they're worried about her, obviously, because it's like, that's one of ours. If she dies, we'll be sad. They didn't say it like that.
We go back to Karofsky outside. He's now So Karofsky is locked in the truck because I think what it is like, because this is such a heavily secured process of taking money out of a bank, basically the truck is completely locked down until Karofsky's coworker can come back in or something like that. So Karofsky is like freaking out. He's on the phone with his boss or something and he's like, yeah, I don't know what's happening. Then he sees not only the fire trucks but now like the hazardous chemical team trucks roll up and like people in intense hazmat suits getting out. So he's like totally freaking out seeing this. And then we see the 118 kind of touching base with this hazardous materials scene team. And they still can't get the vault open. They're trying to figure out, like, well, we need to get oxygen in there at the very least. So they end up, like, finally drilling a hole into the opening of the door of the vault. But, like, there's no way they're going to be able to saw an entire hole into this, like, reinforced steel door.
No, they really have, and it takes a while, because they're, like, we actually get a really interesting sequence of, like, they sort of do match cuts of, like, them drilling into the door, sparks flying. Meanwhile, like, everyone else is, like getting, like, putting, like, decontamination chambers and whatnot before going to the hospital. It's really well done, very well edited. The score is excellent in this scene.
Yeah, I did write really in my notes. I did write in my notes, like, it's hard to even recap this part because it just starts kind of rapid cutting between so many different things happening. Yeah, we're seeing, like, the people who were in the bank but didn't start having symptoms, like the main bank lady and kind of all the other employees getting their decontamination showers, getting taken to the hospital. We're seeing a couple more, like, switches over to Karofsky and the truck. And then, yeah, at one point he does meet up with Buck again. Buck is now in the hazmat suit.
He can't hear anything.
Buck is like, I can't hear you. I have this thing on my head. And Karofsky's just trying to get answers. But he's like, yeah, I can't get out of this truck. Like, the window doesn't roll down. It's an armored car. What do I do? And Buck's just like, okay, see you later.
And, like, gives him a thumbs up. And, like, the fucking face that Max Adler makes in this is amazing. Because he, like, sends the thumbs up back. And it's, like, this frustrated, like, like face, like the scowl, this is like deep scowl. It's like, oh my right. god. Oh my god. And they're both so funny. I will like stand my ground though. I think Oliver Stark, he's an extremely talented actor, and I think one of his best, most underrated skills is just physical comedy.
He is good at that.
He would be so perfect in like sort of a like a slapstick style like a buddy comedy movie, but buddy comedy.
But you Ryan know what Guzman, I mean? Because I'm always saying Ryan Guzman's mm-hmm. forte is also comedy. So
yeah, so they should. Where's their they really should. Episode? You know, if Oliver Stark ever wants to play another role again, I think that that would be a great project for the both of them.
Imagine when the show ends, he just retires.
Oh my god, he's like, well, I've hit my artistic peak. I'm just gonna live off residuals and raise my dogs.
He's like, I played my Lear, you know. Yeah, I did like, my Hamlet.
Buck is his Lear 100%. That's his Brutus, that's everything.
But they're trying to get into the safe, and
it's like a heist. It's like such a great scenario. The 118 has to pull off a heist, and the treasure yeah. inside the safe is hen.
Right, yeah, they have to pull off like a sanctioned heist. And so Bobby, yeah. what do you know, his only idea is to call Michael. Props to this episode mm-hmm. for at least trying to involve Michael in the plot for once. What
this
he does
is, I think, genuinely the most involvement Michael ever has in a call ever.
No, literally.
I think that's genuinely true.
100%. Bobby calls him because Michael, you may or may not remember, is an architect. And Bobby's like, hey, have you ever put in any bank vaults? Which I feel like is kind of a stretch of a question. Like, I feel like in most scenarios, if you asked an architect that question, the answer would probably be no. But yeah. Luckily, Michael is like, yeah, I've put in a couple.
Yeah, because he's not just like an architect. He's also a contractor and everything. So like he works on the ground with like the construction crew. Like you see him like on the job. Like I think he's a very involved artist in that sense.
So Bobby calls him and he's like, okay, so we need to get into a bank vault. Like, can you help us with that? And Michael's like, well, you would need, if you wanted like the blueprints, you'd have to call this office. And he's like, I do know a guy in that office. His name's Chuck. And he likes me. He likes me. So ooh. Bobby's like, well, like him back. You know, Bobby's like, use your masculine wiles to get Chuck to give us those blueprints.
This is why it's important to have a diverse, not only a friend group, but also in terms of like staffing. Like, this is what DEI is all about.
Getting a gay guy who can be hit on by another gay guy in order to give him the blueprints he needs to get a firefighter
exactly.
out of a bank vault.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what it's all about. I just watched that Jubilee debate with Sam Sater and 25 like batshit insane MAGAs, and one of them, it was like a gay Republican, and
mm-hmm. there's always one of those.
Losing my mind listening to this. This gay Republican has been like five of these. I don't even watch Jubilee a lot, but I saw the clips of this and I knew I had to watch the full thing.
Yeah, I can't watch those.
He was, well, Sam is super competent, so like I was happy with that. And it was on the topic of DEI. This stupid person was making the argument that DEI exists as a tax incentive for agencies to get tax breaks for hiring diverse staff. First of all, it's not how that works. And second of all, the topic at hand was specifically like the Department of Government Efficiency, you know, Elon Musk, all that stuff, laying off the DEI task force at, you know, every federal agency.
Mm-hmm. Which, to be clear, most agencies don't have a quote-unquote DEI task force, but yeah. just like DEI policies, or like, you know, they're laying off anyone that they even suspect of being involved with any DEI, which is so ridiculous yeah. for a lot of reasons.
Exactly. It is ridiculous, but the most ridiculous part of this debate specifically is that the focus was on federal agencies and the gutting of those programs as a sort of a wedge to sort of systematically dismantle government agencies in general. It was mm-hmm. the first step in that. And this guy was arguing that the reason these agencies hired people of diverse backgrounds in the first place was for tax incentives, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the privilege of watching Sam slowly and meticulously tried to explain to this stupid person that federal agencies do not have tax incentives to hire people of diverse backgrounds because federal agencies don't pay taxes. They're not taxable institutions. They're funded by taxes. They they don't have any tax incentives at all. And the guy just didn't understand. It didn't make sense in his brain. Because he was too stupid to actually understand what he was talking about.
We found the dumbest gay Republican, which is saying something.
Which is seriously saying something.
Yeah, I just can't watch. I just can't watch those videos because, like, it's too cringeworthy for me, even if they do get destroyed by... And it always feels like an exercise, really, in just, like, platforming that kind of person.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Like, I feel like Jubilee is, like, very irresponsible with that. And I honestly think public debate is just not... I really think that public debate is just not generally a very healthy forum for discussing ideas.
No, because I don't think it ever changes anyone's mind. It is not helpful in the least. Although, you know, public debate about 911 on this podcast is very useful to society.
Yeah, I should clarify. Public political debates specifically regarding very, very important issues... in which the two sides are presented with equal weight. completely uncritically.
Anyhow, I was thinking during this moment where Bobby calls Michael to get his advice for a call, I thought it would be really funny if, like, after this, in, like, every episode, they tried to shoehorn Michael's architectural prowess into the 911 calls. You know, if they're like, Michael, we've got a shark on the freeway. I need you to get us the blueprints to the local aquarium so that we can break into it and get the shark to safety. You know, like, I was just laughing at, like, how convoluted it would be to try and shoehorn him into, like, other 911 calls.
Right. Like, there's that Munchausen by proxy kid in season 4. Mm-hmm. And it's like, Michael, I need you to pull up the schematics of the apartment building this woman lives in so we can pull a heist and break this kid out of here and get him to a real hospital.
It's just always so that they can break into a building.
Literally, they just become the most prolific, like, you know, trespassers in the city's history.
Well, yeah, so Michael, luckily, Michael has his connection Chuck, who does allegedly like him. And, you know, Michael calls back and it turns out, you know,
allegedly likes him. I like the
I mean, like, according to Michael, like, we haven't heard Chuck's side of the story. but Michael has apparently succeeded in getting these schematics of the building. But Michael says, like, in exchange for this, he says he's now going to a Sondheim concert at the Bowl on Friday, which, you know, he says it like it's a bad thing. And I just wrote, like, once again, boring gays. Like, what do you mean your gay character is like, oh, I'm going to a Sondheim concert?
Do you think if Buck went to a Sondheim concert, it would fundamentally change his life? Like, he would walk away from it a changed person.
I do think probably, like, the highest brow art Buck has ever seen is, like, maybe the Meg movies, like, something like that.
And I was so gonna say I the do Hangover.
And so I do think if he were to watch, like a really intensely good piece of art, it no matter what it was, it would probably alter his brain chemistry.
Oh my god, he would hear being alive for the first time. And he would just start to melt. Oh, speaking of being alive, I posted this on my Twitter. I think, did I talk about this in the podcast already? But the fact that I met Raul Esparza.
Oh, yes, you did.
Oh, yes. Well, guess what?
What?
I met him again.
What?
He came
in again.
How
does this keep happening to you?
He likes my restaurant.
He's your Chuck. Well, he's going to invite you to a Sondheim concert.
I didn't really get to talk to him last time. This time I had a full conversation with the guy. Raul Esparza is the nicest person in the entire world. He's so funny. We had a 5-minute conversation about, like, his work and sort of about, like, the restaurant and about, like, the projects he has coming up. He's coming back to Broadway. And so very excited to see that. But yeah, I can't stop glowing about this because, guys, he's literally like one of my, like, top 3 celebrity crushes in the entire world.
I don't see a current relationship in his Wikipedia personal life section, so I think you could really have a shot here, Ryan.
Max Adler says that, you know, he mentions like it could be a plague or whatever, and so, listening to that now, I'm just like, oh, yeah.
I know, I had that thought too. I was like, well, it could have been. Could have been.
But apparently the money's fine. Apparently the money's fine.
And that's all that matters, right?
Yeah, that's all that matters. We'll see about that. But the Michael, he gets the schematics, and he has... So here's the thing. I don't know if it's just me, because I don't see blueprints a lot in my day-to-day life. But, like, for some reason, it didn't cross my mind that they were digital now and interactive and offered, like, different sort of, like, views of the structure of, like, the building. When I hear blueprints, I think of those like very Hollywood, like printed out literal blueprints that are like in like a roll up. And so when he pulled out his iPad or whatever and started like interacting with like a 3D model of the building, like a part of me was like, oh my God, is this illegal? Like to have this information?
I mean, they did make it sound like it was kind of under the table, Michael getting this info. But
it is city planning documents. Like, I don't know what they would be hiding. So
I guess it's a bank vault. So like probably it's not wise to like give that out to the public that there's, because what he ends up finding is that one of the walls is basically just a regular wall of the building and is not reinforced. It's just like a concrete wall. So that's the one that the 118 decides to try drilling into. Their plan is to like drill a bunch of holes in kind of a circle and then try and like bust through that to make a hole in the wall. And
that's such a heist movie staple when like the building has like one little structural weakness because it was just like it just wasn't accounted for, like, oh, the vault was put in years after the structure itself was built, so of course one of the walls facing the outside world is just going to be completely not reinforced at all.
I mean, it is like they say it's like a foot of concrete, so it is a very strong wall, and they end up having kind of a difficult time. They drill the holes, and then I think either Buck or Bobby says, all right, let's start smashing this wall in, and Buck starts going at it with a sledgehammer, and I was just like, you know, Buck was having a great day at work.
Oh my God. This is the moment he's been waiting for. Okay. Like, he's finally being sanctioned to just destroy a wall. The thing that he loves to do more than anything.
They literally just released a sneak peek from the new episode that's airing tonight as of recording this, where Buck is like, they're trying to get into an apartment, and he's like, can we use the battering ram? And Bobby's like, okay, you can use the battering ram. And he like gets so excited and battering rams the door. So I think he loves this.
He loves this. He loves to just like destroy a little bit. You know, he likes to smash. He's so baby girl for that.
Oh, yeah. And in the meantime, we see that at the hospital, the money truck guy dies. He gets declared dead. And when word of that reaches the 118, of course, they're like, well, Hen is still in there. Like, if this thing, we still don't know what this illness or nerve agent or whatever it is. We still don't know what it is or why this guy died. And Hen is in there and she could die. So finally, Buck, being Hen's bestie, not really, but, you know, he loves Hen. He's like, screw it. Like, everybody get out of the way. He gets into the fire truck. And I swear for a second, I thought he was just going to ram the truck into the wall.
I thought the exact same thing. Obviously, they have a winch attached and everything.
Yeah,
and, like,
what was actually set up, which is like they attached like a cable from the truck to the wall so that he can like drive the truck away from the wall and like pull a hole out of it. Which makes sense, but I thought he was going to just crash the truck into the side of the building.
Because it's one of those, like, tow hook. It would have been so Buck. Like, that would have been, like, his final form. Then it probably would have gotten him fired. But the thing about, like, the tow hook and everything, it's like one of those ones on, like, a Jeep, right? Where it's not that strong. Like, it's like, obviously it's strong for, like, a fire engine because it's, like, a heavy vehicle and it's meant to, like, pull cars out of ditches and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But, like, this wall is, like, so powerful. And so, obviously, like, Buck is like, guys, let me just make this a whole lot simpler. And I love that about him.
A whole lot simpler.
I love that it, like for Buck, the best answer is usually the easiest one.
Yeah. The best answer is usually the brute force option.
And it works, but as much as happy as I was that Buck finally got to like rip a wall to pieces, mm-hmm. as soon as he does that and they make a hole in the wall, the technicians get remote access to the bank vault and open the door and allow Chimney inside easily.
Yeah, Chimney is on the inside while the rest of the 118 is doing this on the outside. And like right as they rip the hole in the wall, remote access gets granted. Chimney's like, really? Are you serious? And, you know, right as the 118 like peer into the hole they've made, they see Chimney on the other side, having just walked in.
And it's also it's one of those Hollywood moments where the minute Chim gets in there, Hen wakes up. And right. she's groggy she's and stuff. And it's like, but like, also, I was just thinking, like, because it's been a few hours. And like, if I was Hen, I would just be like, man, how good was that nap? Man.
Oh, I bet it felt like, great.
She woke up feeling well rested. No, she didn't. She had to get stretched out and go to the hospital. Stretched she out. I mean, like, to... she got put on a stretcher, is what I mean.
Yeah, that was a weird way to say that.
That was really,
they didn't
really
like stretch her out on like a medieval torture device. They just put her on a stretcher. And
they said, you know, you've been asleep for a while.
A stretcher, it's time for some yoga. Come to think of it.
Yeah. It is kind of weird. I guess maybe it's because it folds up or something. And so they
maybe,
have to...
yeah. But the next thing we see is after they get Hen out of there and like they're ready to go back to the station, we also see that Karofsky has left the van. So that's kind of a question of like, is he up to something? We're not sure.
The amount of absolute red herrings in this episode. I mean, like him being the... I don't want to spoil anything, but like Karofsky being the ultimate red herring is so funny to me.
He is totally... the episode's big red herring spoilers, but the we see the 118 getting back to the station, and
they say,
you know,
it's not a nerve agent at all or anything, and they're like wondering what it was, and
right, they're saying that was the weirdest day I've had on the job in a long time. And right as they think that, you know, they're just going to get to wrap up their shift and go home, suddenly these cops like speed into the sort of loading bay of the station, and these detectives get out. And Bobby's like, can I help you, detective? And they just run up and start searching the fire engine. You know, Bobby's like, are you going to tell me what this is about? But these cops take these two bags out of like a little compartment in the fire engine. And they dump these bags out onto the floor, and they are full of wad upon wad of cash. Someone has stolen money from the bank vault and hid it in the 118's fire trucks. So that's not looking great for our firefighters. It's kind of looking incriminating.
This is fun for us because we do have absolute irrefutable proof on our end that it was absolutely none of them.
It's kind of interesting that the episode doesn't even try to raise the question of whether any of them were in on it. Like, it has that happen to them externally, like other people suspect of them. But yeah, we as the viewers know that that's not the case.
Which is funny because this goes into this interrogation scene, this Glist-esque interrogation scene. And like they try to give like motives and reasons for why Hen would steal the money, why Eddie would steal the money. And they even like show like flashes to like Hen and Karen. Karen like loses her job. Shannon.
She lost her job at JPL, the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Right. Because so apparently Mars is a non-starter. And
that's a
like...
lore drop. It's funny. In my video, I misspoke and said that Karen works at NASA, and then I looked back at like an episode in season 6 and I was like, oh no, it's like a fictionalized 911 version of NASA. But now hearing that, I'm like, oh no, she did canonically work at NASA.
Yeah,
but then she lost her job.
A rocket scientist, because she was working on like two different programs and both turned out to be like non-starters, which it needs be said is not unheard of for NASA. They do have a bad habit of pouring a lot of money into programs that turn out to ultimately sort of be dead ends. The paramount example being the $209 billion space shuttle program.
Well, we see that kind of, yeah, like you said, we kind of see each character getting interrogated in sequence, and then we start to kind of cut between them. We see that Maddie is the one who took the 911 call, and the detectives start to suspect her and Buck because they were talking about their money problems, because apparently they are trying to get their security deposit back from their landlord, because as we touched on in the last episode, Maddie is trying to move out of her apartment. So they're trying to get their security deposit back. Chimney, they suspect because he's been like at home off of work while he recovers for the last few weeks. So he's had all this time on his hands where he could have plotted a conspiracy. They suspect Bobby for quote unquote conspiring with Michael, which like it does look kind of bad, I guess, that they like got the blueprints of the safe. But also it is totally explicable. Like they did have to do that to get the vault open. Athena, of course, thinks this idea is ridiculous when they interrogate her. They suspect Eddie, partly because he was the first one to suggest that it could have been a nerve agent. They're like, why do you know so much about that? But then also they suspect Eddie.
It's because he was a pretty princess and wanted to share his army knowledge, okay?
Exactly. He was just bragging. But they also suspect him because he, too, has been struggling for money. We see this little cutaway where he has signed Christopher up for surfing lessons that are like $150 an hour. And Shannon is there, queen, and she's saying to him, like, is that a good idea? You know, you tell me not to worry about money, but, like, I'm gonna worry about it. And Eddie is just like, don't worry, babe. He, like, grabs her face with his big, dumb hands, and he's like, it's all gonna be okay, even though I'm giving you no explanation for how we can afford it.
This is literally the most consistent part of Eddie's character.
Literally. He is irresponsible with money.
He will sink as much money as he physically can into making Christopher happy. Like we saw even in the newest episode with the fucking with the fucking
like a PS5 or something.
The PS5 and like even the entire move to Texas. You know, he said that he spent every cent.
so dumb.
His bank account.
I also wrote that in my notes, not specifically about Christopher, but like it is consistent characterization for Eddie to be irresponsible with money because we see this. We see in season three he like impulsively buys a huge expensive truck with his winnings from being in an underground fight club. We'll get to it. But then also, in this most recent season, we see him like buy this house and like start buying Christopher expensive gifts without having a job yet. He's so funny.
It's like, what about Christopher's college fund? Like, what about like
what
you know,
college fund? Come on, let's be serious.
Literally, like what's his like long game here? He doesn't have a long game.
Because
he's
an
idiot.
College fund.
I don't think there is. I think he's banking on a full scholarship.
Which, to be fair, Christopher could do. I believe Christopher's admission essay alone is going to be so he's like, so my two gay dads both almost died like 50 times. I was in a tsunami. My mother died. I have a disability. You know, I've like overcome all this adversity. And
I saw this tweet.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I saw this tweet from this like one European like person or whatever. And they were like, so funny that Americans have to basically flagellate themselves in like 500 words in order to get.
So here's every trauma I've ever suffered.
No, literally. Like it was because like that like personal statement thing, that guy like shared his personal statement and didn't get into like Harvard or whatever. And everyone was like, well, I wouldn't have admitted him either.
Yeah.
And it was just like the one moment where like I saw like a Euro Twitter account like being like kind of mean about like regular Americans having to do like you know fucked up shit because of our you know economy or whatever. That I was like, you know what, that is stupid, and I didn't get defensive about it at all. I normally get so defensive when I see those, 'cause I'm like, you don't know what it's like to live here, buddy. I'm sorry.
No, it is absurd. And, you know, Christopher could put the cherry on top by being like, and I walked in on my dad, like, emotionally cheating on his girlfriend with a carbon copy of my dead mom.
Yeah, and they're like, oh my God, let's get this kid the fuck out of there.
Yeah, at that point, the admissions officers are going to be like, not only are we going to give you a full ride, but also, like, here's a lifetime supply of free therapy.
Here's the number of someone you can call just in case you ever are in a fucking situation.
Here's maybe blink twice if you need help. But
if you can't speak, tap the phone. You know,
so naturally like... they suspect Eddie because Eddie's struggling to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. It kind of seems like a lot of the characters are, so that's like a reason for them to be suspects. We see Eddie has a really corny line where he's like, I've got two full-time jobs, firefighter and dad.
It's like, shut up.
He should get that printed on a t-shirt. And Buck should get, I'm not the stepdad, I'm the dad who stepped up.
I will say Athena in this interrogation, because they bring her in, it's her first appearance all episode, and she just thinks this shit is hilarious, because she knows for a fact that not only did they not do it, but there is no possible way they could ever be organized enough to pull off something as sophisticated as a bank heist. Could
she's you like, imagine you think them Bobby and Michael robbed a bank together? Like, I know you're joking. They start these two dumb cops. This is like one of the dumbest cop episodes of the entire show. I think I talked about in my video how kind of annoying and hypocritical it is that like the show's ultimate goal is to serve the police in every way, but then also we have an episode like this where you have these two plainly incompetent cops who are treated as stupid and incompetent the whole time.
Yeah.
But they keep having to like just capitulate to everything they want because like the show can't possibly actually critique them, even though they're clearly framing them as stupid and incompetent. It's just kind of annoying.
I will say at least framing them as stupid and incompetent is kind of a breath of fresh air, at least for me.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, when they're ransacking everybody's houses, Athena's just like, well, you got to let the wheels of justice do their thing.
Trust the process, you know, just trust the process.
But yeah, they also start to get on Bobby for his past. You know, they start to really poke at that sensitive wound. And we see Buck say that he trusts Bobby's gut, whatever that means. And finally, we see Karofsky is also getting interrogated. And he is adamant that he really doesn't know what happened. But then he finds out that, in fact, the money that was stolen not from the vault, but from the armored car. So that does kind of incriminate Karofsky.
My favorite moment from this entire interrogation sequence, because it is an excellent sequence. I think it's so
very fun.
They're like sort of trying to pick apart the members of the 118, and they're talking to Hen, and they say that one of your team members said you were, you know, quote, cranky this morning. It wasn't that. She was like, they said something else, and then Buck corrects them and says, cranky. I said she was cranky.
Yeah.
And which, first of all, kind of out of pocket of Buck, but then we flash back to the 118 doing Chimney's welcome back party, and Hen is like running that shit like the military.
She has become like a bridezilla of welcome back parties, basically.
You know, Buck is like kind of like, you know, Chim said that he didn't want a big party, and Buck is like, what if we just respect his wishes? And Hen's like, we are not respecting his wishes. We are throwing him a party, and we're eating a cake to show him that we love him. I love that delivery.
Meanwhile,
so
Buck and Eddie are on two ladders opposite each other, trying to hang up this banner that says Chimney 2, Death 0.
And there's Athena also with a
there's
cake.
Also, just... Yeah, there's also a funny moment where Athena comes in with a cake, and like they open up the box and they see it's just like a plain white cake. And so
just
Buck's like, isn't this kind of lackluster after the last cake we got him had like a statue of his head with a licorice rebar through it? And Hen is like, well, this time he only got stabbed.
He only got stabbed. They
Which
couldn't have
fair.
At least done like a red cake or something, like a red velvet.
cake full of stab wounds.
Right,
have
no,
you
literally.
Seen, there was like a trend on like Swiftie TikTok, I think, where people were making this. I forget what song. I feel like it was associated with Taylor Swift, but maybe I'm even making that part up. But there was something where people would make this kind of cake where like they would rig it with something where when you stabbed the cake, like this red, like blood like liquid would spurt out of it. They should have done a cake like that. That sounds like something from
the press cycle for the new Doja Cat album. And by new, I mean her most recent. There's nothing new about it.
But finally, at the end of this montage, we kind of get a quick cut to everyone. And then it ends on Buck saying, I'm so confused. Can you start over? And
he's
then
so
I think
stupid.
We cut to commercial.
I love him. That's like, oh my God, that's such a quintessential Buck moment.
Yes, that's a classic Buck himbo moment.
Oh my goodness. I love that. I love that, man. But we come back from commercial, and Hen and Athena, they're going back to the bank. Basically, Hen is sort of retracing her steps because she wants to give the most accurate testimonial as possible to sort of clear her name in this, because she's implicated. They're kind of like going at Hen the hardest because she was the one in the vault. And,
which is very silly because as she established in the interrogation, she's like, well, yeah, I was in the vault unconscious for the entire time. And like the whole thing, well, I guess not the whole thing is on camera, but you know, mm-hmm. seeing her pass out is on camera.
Yeah. Mr. Prentice, apparently, the woman Nina lets them back in. She says they're gonna be closed for the week while they do mm-hmm. repairs on the building. Apparently Mr. Prentice was terrified of getting locked in the vault, and she mentioned something about a kid in Florida, and she doesn't really elaborate on that, but mm-hmm. I believe that will be important down the road.
Yeah, I think they mention it again.
Then she lets them into the bank vault because they explain kind of their purpose in being there. And Hen starts looking around. Things are kind of coming back to her. It's all coming back to me now. And
yeah,
there's something so stupid and major that the cops missed in their check. Like, yes. This is like the ultimate incompetent moment where, like, it doesn't even, they see this, like, I mean, Hen's lying down on the ground obviously when she sees this, but like it's mm-hmm. visible from standing at the right angle, not even like like a particularly like unique angle, just like an angle enough that you get a vantage point. You see the hand sanitizer bottle that the manager guy was using underneath the desk or the table inside the vault. You know, then like she gets this like little flash of recognition of like mm-hmm. he touched my face, like what's about this. She gets a hunch basically.
Yeah. And they call in the detectives because, you know, they don't want to disturb the evidence. The detectives pick this up, and literally their first line is, "I can't believe we missed that." It's like you guys suck at your jobs.
I can't believe it either. Yeah, I can believe that, because you're fucking
idiots.
And
so Hen shares her theory, which is that there must be some kind of toxin in the hand sanitizer since the guy touched her face. And the detectives don't even seem to take her that seriously. But suddenly, mm-hmm. the bank lady is like, "You guys, mm-hmm. come in here and check every box in the vault again." And they're like, "What's happening?" She says, "Box 725 is supposed to have $6 million worth of diamonds in it, not the recycling." Because box 725 is not full of $6 million worth of diamonds. It is full of like a crumpled up water bottle. So something is going on, and they realize that Mr. Prentice must have had something to do with it. Like, that's the only explanation. So they go mm-hmm. to his house, they open the door, and he is dead on the ground. One of the detectives is like, "I hate this case. Like, you know, why is there so much weird, convoluted stuff happening?" It's because you're in a TV show, babes. It's because you're in a TV show.
Before they cut to that scene, there's a fun little like Hen moment where they look at the empty box, and the detectives go, "Where are the diamonds, Wilson?" And the camera like zooms into her face, and she just goes, "Seriously?"
Well, no, Ryan, you're getting it mixed up. That happens in the ensuing scene that I was describing.
Oh.
It's when they're at his house and they find the dead guy. And then the detective turns around and he's like, "So where are the diamonds?" Or something. He's like, or no, he says something about like his accomplice, something about his accomplice. And he's like, "What do you know about that, Wilson?" And then, slow zoom on her face.
Seriously. And she's so over it. "Sorry, guys. Sorry. Sorry. I got my little scene. I'm sorry.
It's like
I'm
you didn't even watch this episode."
You're right. I didn't. Let me just throw all my notes away. I'm sorry. I'm going by my notes. I'll screenshot my notes app and I'll post it on the corporate account just to prove to everyone that I watched the episodes.
No, I believe it. I just like maybe your notes were kind of sloppy.
I actually fully believe that because I took them this morning. Right.
Well, so did I. Yeah, they somehow still think it's Hen, which is pretty ridiculous. You know, we cut to commercial again, come back. Athena is at her house getting the kids ready for school when, you know, she's like, "Oh, I'm going to take you to school today because your dad and I are going to be pretty busy." And they're like, "What are you talking about? We didn't hear about anything." She's like, "It's a surprise." She opens the door. The cops are at her door. They're like, "How did you know we were coming?" And she says, "You know, I don't know. She expected it. She knows how these things work," or something. Athena is in the cutest black knit shirt, I have to say. Very, very good, gorgeous shirt. And
a gorgeous shirt, and she like lets them in. She's like, "Coffee's like in the pot," or whatever. She's like,
classic deferent Athena is like, she just lets the cops come in and ransack her house because she has no spine when it comes to cop authority. She's like, "I get it. It's all part of the process." And what do we know? The cops are doing this to every character's house. So Scenario by A Tribe Called Quest, Needle Drop, kind of fun fun needle drop we get. Like, mm-hmm. every character opens the door to these cops. The cops are being, again, very incompetent and, like, very, like, boorish and unpleasant. Like, they're just throwing yeah. everybody's stuff all over the place, which I believe is true to life.
This is how they do it. Yeah, they basically ransack your house and they don't clean up after themselves. It's mm-hmm. it's very, like, having your home or your apartment, like, whatever, searched by the cops is a very invasive process. And they
Isn't
leave
it great
you
that that's
to deal
what
with
your tax payer dollars are going to, guys?
Sometimes they'll literally, like, tear up your mattress, like, looking for
yeah.
shit if they, like, suspect
just, like,
you have
stuff.
Shit. Yeah, and it's like, oh, I guess I have to clean that up myself. I have to get a new fucking mattress.
Yeah.
Great.
They
you
even
know.
Are searching and ransacking the fire station. You see them, like, going through the lockers. I would be so pissed if I, like, showed up to work the next day and I'm like, why did they, like, mess up all my food in the fridge, you know? Like, that, I would
as
be so annoyed.
As if cops and firefighters didn't have enough, like, problems between them.
True.
You know, like, this
like
is just going to make things
worse.
They threw
all my Diet Coke in the trash. Like, what the fuck?
It could have had diamonds in it or something. I don't know.
Well, we see them take Michael's laptop, even.
Yeah.
We see them messing mm-hmm. up Chimney's color-coded socks, which is so mm-hmm. uncalled for.
They take, apparently Buck has a bunch of clothes in his trunk. I guess
yeah.
he just, like, has spares or whatever.
I mean, it's fair to assume that, like, he does work 24-hour shifts, so, like, it probably is reasonable mm-hmm. to have clothes in your car. But yeah, the funnier yeah. explanation is, like, what does he just, like, live out of his car sometimes whenever he yeah. finds himself without an apartment, which happens to him pretty frequently.
Maybe he goes on road trips. Maybe he likes to, like,
True.
See the countryside or something. So he True. Has his Jeep and everything, and they're, like, just tearing it apart. I still can't get over the fact that Buck drives a Jeep.
Very styles of him.
They're, like, the sisters from another mister. I love them both. Maddie comes over, she has to order an Uber to work because she still has to go to work.
And this is too early in the timeline of the show for the Uber driver to show up, and it's Eddie.
And it's Eddie, right? My God. Maybe that's how
She's
he's
like, man,
Chris's
this
serving
Uber
lessons.
Driver is only rated, like, 2.5 stars.
I'm sorry I wouldn't let you guys fuck in the backseat. I'm sorry. I've cleaned it so many times and you guys never tip. It's hard out here in El Paso, you know? After the montage, we Michael shows up to Athena's, and Athena's house looks absolutely spotless.
Yeah. I mean, maybe she, as a cop, like, knows how to clean up
well,
after
that's
the
what,
cops
that's,
search your house.
One would assume, but, you know, after the scene, we'll talk about the scene itself, but after the scene, like, sort of plays out, Michael, like, makes note of it, and she says that the cops were very, very careful when they searched my house, and it's like, oh. And, like, Michael says, like, because they're afraid of you, and it's like, I just thought it was, you know, them, like, you know, not respecting anyone except for another cop.
Yeah, that's wild. We find yeah. out they even took Harry's computer, not just Michael's computer, which he has a line where he says, what, they think he's robbing banks and playing Minecraft? So for the record, we were 100% correct in assuming yeah. that Harry was a Minecraft kid.
Minecraft kid,
but
which we
this
knew.
This scene pisses me off in terms of the copaganda, because I hate the way Hen kind of starts this scene talking to Athena. She's like, you know, I'm a little worried about the way that this process seems to be kind of unfairly tipped towards me. And, you know, yeah. she's essentially talking about potentially being racially profiled. And she also mentions yeah. that she has some skeletons in her closet that she doesn't really mm-hmm. want brought into this situation, yep. like the stuff with
Eva gets name dropped. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And yep. Athena just kind of totally brushes it off. She's like, oh, you think that's what's going on here? And it's like, well, Athena, it's not that unreasonable to talk about. And yeah, the investigation does seem to be, like, really skewed towards Hen for some reason, even though
yeah.
there's really no evidence
out
that she
the
did
entire
anything.
Time. Like, literally yeah, passed so, out the entire time.
So Athena just totally brushes her off. She's like, oh, it's fine. Just let the wheels of justice do their thing. And it's like, Athena, come on. Like, this is what I'm talking about. She won't even defend yeah. the people closest to her from this sort of thing.
Yeah, it's, like, insane. It's so frustrating to watch Like, because that's your friend, and your friend's not even saying like, I think they're gonna, like, you know, put me in jail or something like that, mm-hmm. because of something I didn't do. She's not even saying that. She's just saying, you know, I'm anxious about how these people are interacting with me, because it's just making me feel uneasy. And she's not even validating that. She's just like, well, you just gotta trust the process and let the system do its thing. And it's like,
I feel like, if they wanted to write,
fucking comfort is that?
I feel like if they wanted to write Athena as a more sympathetic cop character, yeah, they could have her like still ultimately be pro cop, but be like, yes, validate her feelings, and, you know, maybe acknowledge more that is a thing that could happen. She could be like, listen, if it starts to look that way, like, I'll use all of my cop power to defend you, or to try and, you know, get involved in this investigation or something. But no, like,
we've,
she doesn't say anything like
that.
She's just like, no, you're crazy,
Athena,
man.
And her authority, you know, and like, so Athena does have the authority to she's a sergeant, you know, and she could fully just be like, you know, like doing like what you just said. But instead, no, she's just like, yo, you just gotta trust the process.
She just totally invalidates the anxiety. She's like, basically like, no, that's not real. You're crazy.
it's
after Michael comes in, then Hen suddenly gets a call from the hospital, and she finds out that like her results came back of like her blood and stuff. And she says, you'll never guess like what I was poisoned with. And Athena goes, let me guess, scorpion venom. You're like, whoa, what's going on here? But I guess Athena like just got a text about it from like the cops or whatever. So she also knows. Yeah, Hen was poisoned with scorpion venom, and mm-hmm. which was in the hand sanitizer. And Hen is like, I know who did this, which is a hilarious way to leave the scene, because like, what mm-hmm. what a series of like total non sequiturs. Like, we would never be able to guess that from what we heard earlier. But for the record, this is about to connect to a thing we heard earlier. We saw.
We didn't mention it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You'll remember from the last episode, we met a oddly East Coast sounding maintenance guy who works on the fire trucks. His name is Marty. And he was talking to the 118 as they were preparing Chimney's like surprise party. And he mentioned that his arthritis in his hands has gotten better ever since he first started doing acupuncture and then got referred to a witch doctor. And he says, like, you'll never guess what they have me on now. And then he kind of gets cut off and we move on. So I guess this is a callback to that. And what mm-hmm. do you know? After the commercial, Marty shows up to work and Chimney's there. And he's like, he's been called in to work. Marty has been called in to work. They basically have staged like a Marty arrest intervention.
It's like a sting. They stage like a sting where everyone comes out of like the fire trucks.
The drama of it is so funny that they all hid in the fire trucks, you know, to make their dramatic entrances one by one.
And it's so perfectly in character as something that these dramatic ass motherfuckers would totally do.
They're like, if a high school drama club was a firefighting team.
They really are. And it's just, this is part of what makes it such a perfect episode, is just how campy and over the top it is.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, Chimney was like, ooh, can I please be the first one to come out of the fire truck?
Right. I want to be his first impression. And then Eddie, of course, like, is right there, like,
stage
ooh, that
manager.
Sounds fun. Let me do it too.
You know? Stage manager Eddie was probably running the whole show. He's like, okay, now, then next, like, we're going to have Buck come out of the truck. Bobby, mm-hmm. you're going to come out. I forget who the next person. Yeah. But, you know, so they all confront him and they mention that. Oh, I forget what even happens. They start confronting him about it.
It's supposed to be non-lethal. Apparently, it's not like a Deathstalker scorpion or something. It's probably just like one of those little like bitchy ones that you find in like a wall in Phoenix.
Right.
And then it turns out the reason Billy died. I'm skipping ahead. Sorry. I'm jumping the gun a little bit, because they sort of start to reveal that they've caught on to exactly what he's doing, how he hid the money in the truck. And then the minute Marty catches on to what's happening, he makes a run for it. He tries to run out of the station.
I thought the cops would have tackled him,
but instead the cops just roll up.
Yeah, the cops
were about to enter from the other direction,
so they just stop him. I also thought it was kind of funny that the 118 didn't even try to run after him, but yeah, they probably knew that the cops were around the corner. They take him to the interrogation room, And yes,
oh, they say that you're under arrest for like grand larceny and murder. And he's like, murder? Who did I murder?
Yeah, I don't know about no murder. But yeah, so they get him in the interrogation room and they start describing, yes, that the scorpion venom can treat RA. And then they reveal that the armored car guy had an allergic reaction to the venom, and that's why he died.
Yeah. Karofsky IDs Marty. So great red herring, bringing it all back together.
Great red herring.
We needed one more Karofsky appearance before the episode is over.
We did.
And Buck is sort of breaking it down.
Here's what happens, you guys. The 118 is back at the station, like having a meal, and they start breaking down the solved mystery exactly like, this is a deep cut, but exactly like the end to an episode of Perry Mason. Do we have any Perry Mason viewers out there? I am not talking the HBO series. I'm talking the 50s and 60s one.
I've seen Perry Mason. I liked Perry Mason because I used to see reruns on it on TV Land. I think it was. And so I watched a few episodes with my grandma when I was when I would stay over at her and my grandpa's house.
Well, I'm very excited to hear this. I'm very excited to hear this because I come from a Perry Mason family. It's kind of one of our things is that especially like at our cabin, we have this kind of very, very like rustic cabin in northern Wisconsin that has like, you know, for the longest time, it didn't have any internet. It has like very hard water. And for a long time, we only had this like 12-inch black and white TV up there and it couldn't get like broadcast or any channels or anything. So we just had a DVD player hooked up to it. And we would bring specifically DVDs of Perry Mason.
Oh my God.
We had like all the seasons on DVD. We would just watch that. And as a kid, I found it incredibly boring. And I still find it pretty boring. But every once in a while, you get a good episode with like a really standout performance from like the person who ends up confessing in the courtroom at the end. One of me and my mom's favorites is there's this guy who like confesses at the end of an episode. And he's like, all right, I did it. I killed the old gas bag. And I think they should do that on 911. But anyway, at
I was getting major Scooby-Doo vibes from this is what I was getting.
It's like a trope in a lot of mystery things, but I really associate it with Perry Mason. And they were probably one of the first to do it. It's the thing where at the end of an episode, every episode of Perry Mason ends with the characters sitting around, often at like a cafe. You've got like Perry, you've got Della, you've got Paul Drake, and they're sitting around with like the defendant who's been let off. And they are talking about like, so tell me one thing, Perry, if this person put the knife in the glove compartment, then what was that person doing at the whatever? And they're like, well, you see, it was all to get this to happen. And so that's what they're doing at the 118. They're all sitting around and they're like, so, you know, why would Marty team up with Mr. Prentice?
And it's like, well, Franklin and Marty were ex-brothers-in-law. And
Franklin was married to Marty's crazy sister, who we did get a mention of either in this episode or the last one, maybe both.
Yes, no, we did. I think it was in the last episode, and so it was like good planting and payoff. Basically, the fake nerve agent was a distraction for the armored car robbery, which was in turn a distraction for the most valuable piece of the puzzle, which was the $6 million worth of diamonds. They were ex-brothers-in-law, and so they teamed up to steal everything. The 118 was the mule to get the money to the station, and they would have picked that up, but what Marty wasn't counting on was the fact that Franklin double-crossed him. This is something that they talk about in Ocean's 8. Cate Blanchett confronts Sandra Bullock and she says, you don't run a job in another job. It becomes too convoluted and things collapse in on themselves. And so Franklin goes to leave, but by that point it was too late, and Marty had caught on to the fact that Franklin had double-crossed him and strangled him where he stood in his home. And it all zooms in on Marty.
But we cut back to Marty at the interrogation room, and he's like, "What? I didn't do that.
What? I didn't kill anyone." You know.
And we find out that Marty was not even aware that Franklin was pulling this diamond heist. This was Franklin double crossing him. And so in the vault, when Hen was passed out, Franklin woke up and he like went over to the diamond box and he opened up this box of diamonds. He had a little bottle of water and he just swallowed every diamond. The reveal for this.
Oh my God.
Because they're like, then what happened to the diamonds? We see Franklin, who has died, right, is getting his autopsy at the morgue.
Yeah.
And this coroner is like noting like, oh, there's like traces of corn in his stomach, some sort of grain and some kind of foreign mass. And she picks it up with her little tongs or whatever. And she's like, it looks like a diamond. And then we see that in the vault, he just swallowed all these diamonds. I just wrote in my notes, ouchie.
It's so gross. It's like, so perforated stomach. He dies like hard.
Right? I had to look this up because I could have sworn that I heard once about like a dramatic, like, medieval form of like suicide where you would like swallow diamonds, but maybe I'm remembering that wrong. So I just had to look up like, will swallowing diamonds kill you? And I read that 80 to 90% of ingested foreign bodies will pass without intervention. Objects with sharp objects or objects with sharp edges or pointed tips have the highest risk of complications. So yeah, diamonds being so hard and often having sharp edges, like there's a good chance of that cutting up your insides.
Like the point at the end of it. Yeah, that makes sense. The reason why the cops were able to go to the firehouse so directly is because Franklin had sent an anonymous tip as to where the money was through 911. As a part of his double-crossing, Marty was the fall guy, right? But he didn't account for the fact that apparently he didn't have... here's my question. Why did he jump right to let me swallow these and then break out the colander later? Like, why would he do that? Why wouldn't he bring a bag with him? They're not large diamonds. This is a little section of small.
It's not like he had to get through any security. He went to the hospital, but even then he could have just kind of hid that in his pocket and like kept it a secret. You'd think
at the very most. And okay, I know. I'm speaking at this with perhaps maybe a different angle than maybe he would have thought about this. Maybe in his mind, swallowing the diamonds was more dignified than what I'm suggesting. But there are other orifices that have proven more effective in hiding contraband than your mouth and your stomach.
He just wasn't ready to commit to the bit on that level, I think.
It's $6 million in diamonds. $6 million. You better commit to it. Like, do whatever you have to do, okay?
Prepare for a goddamn
colonoscopy. I'm sorry.
Presumably, Franklin dies. This guy deserved from trying to die. The diamonds.
He was like, weak.
Which, like, if you swallow a few diamonds, you'll probably be fine. But I do think swallowing this many at once probably increased his likelihood of complications. And of course, then we cut to Athena and Bobby are like having dinner at Bobby's place. And they're just laughing about it, about this man dying horribly. And they say, like, well, the official report said he died of, like, an intestinal blockage. And Athena's like, they wouldn't take what I thought it should be. Cause of death, greed. And they're, like, laughing it up. It's like, you guys, he died, like, probably from some horrible, like, a perforated bowel or something awful. But they're just laughing it up. And suddenly there's a knock at the door. And it's the fire chief. The chief of the LAFD. Bobby's like, what are you doing here, chief, whatever your name is? And he's like, I need to talk to you. I'm sorry, there's no easy way to say this. They introduce him to Athena. He's like, you know, can I talk to you alone? Bobby's like, I'd rather Athena stay here. And the guy reveals that they've found out. They say, like, the 118 was cleared after this bank heist thing, but you were not. And so at first you're like, what? Like, did he contribute to the heist in some way? No, they're like, we need to do some investigations into your past, Bobby, because of what we found out through this investigation. You are now suspended from, you're on suspended duty pending a full inquiry. And he's being very vague about it. So of course, Athena's like, you need to explain yourself. Like, why is he being suspended? And he basically says, Captain Nash lied to us about his past. And, you know, Athena's like, lied about what? And Bobby says, about what happened in Minnesota.
Oh.
But done, hey, we done, Minnesotans done. Have a saying. We have a saying. We say what happens in Minnesota stays in Minnesota.
Stays in Minnesota.
That's a joke. Oh. We don't say that, but we could. And I just think, you know, why should the LAFD be so concerned with what happened in Minnesota? Just because it involved the deaths of 148 people,
yeah. Jesus Christ. I saw this and I had a part of me, because Bobby has moved on so much in his personal life, a part of me had completely forgotten that what happened in Minnesota, first of all, the extent of what happened, and also that it had ramifications.
Yeah.
that's such a weird thing to say, but it's something that happens when you watch a show like this and this character has this traumatic backstory with something awful that they've done. And they move and they start to, like, their story is about sort of moving on from that. And then mm-hmm. you kind of move on from it too. I'm sorry, but I was watching this. I'm like, guys, can't you just give it a rest?
Yeah, like, who cares? Come on.
Yeah. Like, what? Do you think the people in Minnesota are still upset about it? They're dead, you know?
Those 148 people, their families have moved on. Give it a rest. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, always digging up the past, these LA people.
Yeah, but I just got frustrated with it because I'm like, oh, man. Whatever.
Still.
Yeah. Still. So you can't just let it go. Cops can never just let something go. I'm always saying this.
So that's our big cliffhanger for the episode. And we are getting to the end of the season, miraculously. Yeah. That's our big cliffhanger, is that Bobby is under investigation and he might lose his job because apparently he hasn't been quite honest about his full past, which is also kind of intriguing because it's like, whoa, like, we assumed that he was honest about all of these things. So it's like, what has he been hiding? How much of this was, like, willful obfuscation on his part?
This episode, I will say, this episode, I said at the top that I like how streamlined it is, and I absolutely stand by that. It's not a bottle episode in any meaningful way, but it mm-hmm. does kind of feel like one in the broader context of the rest of the show.
It's a
concept episode, you know, where, like, it's so focused on, like, one particular storyline that doesn't have anything really to do with any of the characters. And I really like that. I wish they would do that more because I feel like it gave the episode such a strong sense of flow and almost urgency. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I really liked just how keen the writers were on, like, you know, keeping the plot going, like, keeping things moving forward, because we have a lot of ground mm-hmm. to cover. You know, there wasn't really any time to meander, which I appreciated.
Yeah, totally.
There was no meandering bullshit, which unfortunately has become kind of a mainstay.
Yeah, we've been trying to make good time, like, since you have kind of a hard out at 2:30, mm-hmm. but I think it's like, we
this
also
was kind
just
of the
made
perfect
good time
episode for it, you know?
Yeah, we didn't have to spend too long discussing anything because things just keep moving along.
Yeah, it's not like something where, like, every scene has, like, ramifications for the character and we have to, like, you know,
we
stop
have to
and
be
talk
like,
about
okay,
the characters
let's talk
and
about, let's unpack this.
Yeah, the only thing we have to really unpack is the propaganda stuff in this episode, which was, you know, more than usual.
Mm-hmm. It was unpackable, to be sure.
It was definitely unpackable. But the rest, honestly, like, I'm trying to think about, like, what else there is to say about this episode other than it's really solid. It's really focused. And mm-hmm. I like that. I like that. And I think that that's a trend that maybe this show could explore more going forward. Not that I don't like, you know, the classic style of episodes with, like, A, B, and C plots, and mm-hmm. every character has their own drama and there's split time focusing on each of it, but it's a nice change of pace when the show sticks a storyline and commits to it, you know. It reminds me of other procedurals.
Love,
in that sense,
I do love the concept episodes. I do mm-hmm. love them.
Yeah, so good on that for this episode. Who was the writer on this episode again? Same guy who did Buck Bothered and Bewildered. And
yes, it was Andrew Myers.
Andrew Myers. Good job, Andy. Good job.
Good job, Andy.
We appreciate you and we love you. And if you want to talk more about this and, you know, Buddy and other things, come on the pod.
You don't have to talk about Buddy. Just come on the pod.
But we know you want to.
We know you want to. Kind of sounds, come on. We've seen these episodes.
We're also always down to talk about Kim. Hero Ashes to Ashes, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right. Oh, my God. Maybe he's a Kim. Maybe he could give us some Kim insight.
But some yes. Kim insight. We'll invite him and Devin Kelly on at the same time.
I already invited Devin Kelly and their people never got back to me. But yeah, everybody have a great rest of your night / day. And listen, mm-hmm. everybody pray for gay Eddie, okay? Everybody pray for him. Everybody pray. We are on God. Eddie. We're getting that man out. We're getting him out. And it could be any day now. Us.
Oh my God. I'm so excited to see how this shapes up. I don't think it'll be this week. I do think it could very possibly be next week. And I am I would like to see it. I would like to see it.
I don't think it's controversial to say we would both like to see it.
I think it's pretty expected of us at this point. All right. Well, good night, everyone. And don't forget to, you know, go to a Sondheim concert every once in a while. It'll be a very edifying experience.
What's like a funny thing we could say to wrap this up?
Listen, if you're trying to smuggle diamonds out of a bank, just remember, not the mouth. There are easier ways.